This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Police departments are preparing for the possibility of violence on Election Day. Some pro-Trump far-right militants are preparing for the possibility of civil war. My guest Mike Giglio writes about one such militant group, the Oath Keepers, that he says has tapped into a deep current of anxiety that could cause a surprisingly large contingent of people with real police and military experience to consider armed political violence. Giglio got access to a leaked database of the Oath Keepers membership from 2009 to 2015. Nearly 25,000 people were on that list. About two-thirds of them had a background in the military or law enforcement. About 10% was active duty. Giglio spent several months interviewing current and former members of the group, trying to understand their motivations and how serious they were about taking up arms. He also interviewed the group's founder and leader, Stuart Rhodes, who has warned crowds to be ready for war. This is a prospect that Giglio finds especially disturbing because he's covered civil wars in Syria, Ukraine, and Iraq, and has witnessed the suffering they've caused. He's also the author of a book about ISIS called Shatter the Nations. His article about the Oath Keepers is in the November issue of The Atlantic. Mike Giglio, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
You spoke to many current and former members of the Oath Keepers. Are they preparing in case there is a civil war, or do they want to start a civil war?
It's more the former. So they believe that there is a very strong likelihood of civil violence in America. And, you know, they've been prepping for this in their minds, in some cases, since the group started in 2009. And all the events of the Trump presidency and of the last year, for a lot of them, have made them feel like it's more likely that there's going to be some form of conflict. All of them said that they don't want it to happen, but they're at the point where they feel like they might not have a choice. And so preparations is really the kind of embracing was the dominant mood of these people when I spoke to them.
Who do they think is going to start the civil war?
In their view, the political left, Antifa, leftist agitators, if you speak with some of them, they have a very dire view that says that maybe it already started on a smaller scale. So they are casting themselves as defensive even as they use this very aggressive rhetoric.
So some of them see signs that a civil war is inevitable. What are some of the other signs?
If you think about their worldview, it holds that the federal government and state governments will seek to use almost tyrannical power to control the population. So the mandates that came down from the coronavirus, the lockdowns, that reinforced that worldview. The fear of protests from the political left and of riots is very prevalent in their worldview. It's something that they talk about for years. And when they saw the protests against police brutality take place this summer, and when they saw the riots that were connected to some of those, that reinforced the idea that there is some sort of unrest coming or even already here. And, you know, they really listen to the way that President Trump portrays these events. So if you listen to Trump's own comments, it's, you know, he's portraying the governor of Michigan, for example, as almost tyrannical. He's portraying the protesters as leftist insurrectionists who are bent on looting and destruction. It really feeds into their worldview. And so that's why over the course of the year that I was talking to them, they became more and more convinced that these events were actually playing out.
It's interesting that they're so pro-Trump in the sense that you think of the far-right militant groups as being anti-government. But this group is so pro-Trump and he's the president.
It's actually an important point. This is the first time that militant groups like this have had someone in the White House that they fully support. They were really skeptical of the first George Bush administration, for example, and even George H.W. Bush. Not as much as they've been skeptical of Democrats, but they really never felt like they had an ally in the White House. And from the beginning of Trump's presidential campaign in 2015, they were almost fully on board. And, you know, he speaks their language. And, you know, they are very passionately Trump supporters. And it really is a change for these groups. And I think, you know, what I detected is that they still haven't quite figured out how to square what they used to say about the power of the government and being a check on that with the fact that they're just, you know, full-fledged behind the president right now. And I think that's a big contradiction.
Why is a relatively large percentage of the group comprised of current and former members of the police and the military?
The Oath Keepers are unique, and this is the reason that I decided to focus on them, in that they expressly recruit and focus on people with military and police experience. That's how they build themselves. And I think what their founder has been very successful at doing is tying the idea that there is this sort of movement on the political left that is anti-police, anti-military, and making this into an idea that what this militant movement is actually some version of patriotic. And it's a place for Trump supporters and gun rights advocates and military and police professionals and the people who very wholeheartedly support them. He calls it the warrior class. And this has sort of been a dream for him to try to channel that into some sort of political force. And he told me, even in February of this year, the first time I spoke with him, that he was using what he called a drumbeat of police demonization on the left to help his efforts at outreach to these communities. And as the year progressed, I saw him taking that and really trying to hammer it home.
So we've talked a little bit about what the Oath Keepers believe in and the possibility of civil war that they're preparing for. What are some of the things the group has actually done so far?
They are most famous for having a team of people who went to the protests in Ferguson, Missouri after Michael Brown's killing. And they went with their AR-15 style rifles and they patrolled the crowds and they stood guard on the roofs of the rooftops of local businesses. And, you know, to them, they were protecting businesses from looting and arson and rioting. To the protesters, it was a provocation. It was portrayed as, you know, them being there to intimidate the protesters. But really, you know, this was also kind of like a coming out party for the group. It was all over the media. And actually, I was overseas at the time. But that was the first that I ever heard of the Oath Keepers. I remember seeing a news image of an Oath Keeper standing on a rooftop with his rifle and kind of staring out into the distance and just the hair on the back of my neck standing up and just wondering what was happening in America. And it was interesting for me actually to, over the course of reporting this story, connect with that same person and talk with him about, you know, what he saw, you know, through his own eyes while he was doing that.
Oh, so what did he see through his eyes?
He thought that he was there for the public good. He thought, you know, he's been defined by that photo, and I think he struggled with that. But in his mind, they were protecting the community. And you know, the way I describe it in the article, and the way I saw it is you know, whatever they had in mind, that photo and became an image of a country that was starting to turn on itself.
What are some of the ways that you think President Trump has enabled militant far-right groups like the Oath Keepers?
I think what the president says and what his allies say really means a lot. And one thing I found is that the Oath Keepers and the part of the militant right that they represent are listening very closely to what the president is saying, and they believe him. You know, they think he's a truth teller. And you know, one example of that is I spoke to dozens of people over the course of reporting this article this year, and I asked almost every single one of them, "What will you do if the president says that the vote was stolen? If he's declared the loser of the election, but he says that there was fraud and it was stolen?" And almost every one of them said, "Well, we all know that there was massive fraud by Democrats in 2016. They just take that as fact, and it's because Trump has been saying it for 4 years, and also because parts of the conservative media establishment and Republican politicians have in different ways been supporting him in that idea that voter fraud is this real problem and that maybe it did happen in some massive way, like the president says in 2016. But they're very attuned to that, and they're listening very closely when he's saying it's already happening for 2020.
It sounds like the Oath Keepers might be in disarray. They've lost some members. People who know Rhodes told you that his behavior had become erratic. He was disbarred, I think, in 2015. In 2018, his wife petitioned for an order of protection during divorce proceedings, alleging he'd once grabbed their daughter by the throat and had a habit during marital arguments of waving a pistol in the air before putting it to his head. So what's the state of the Oath Keepers now?
I spoke to a number of people who had left who told me that there was just a great deal of dysfunction in the way that the group was run. And I think, you know, one thing I tried to make clear in the article, because I know it's pretty eye-popping when we say, hey, I've got these files that were leaked. They show everyone that signed up to be a member of the Oath Keepers over a 6-year period, and it's 25,000 names. And I think you could run with that and say, oh my goodness, like they have a 25,000 person army at the ready. But that definitely wasn't the case. You know, I spoke to so many people who had left for various reasons. You know, in some cases it was the idea like, hey, I thought it was about gun rights. You know, I signed up and then I went into their forums and it was way more, you know, extreme than I thought it would be. And so I left. Or, you know, people had all kinds of ideological differences with the group. And so, you know, I really think the way to see it is it's a mindset that is way more prevalent than we might expect, and that is subscribed to by regular citizens. These are not, you know, wild-eyed militiamen off in the woods somewhere. These are people who go to work every day. These are current or former police officers, people who hold regular jobs, members of the community. I think the idea that so many people from regular society have at least considered going down this path is very jarring and says a lot about the kind of anxieties that exist in the country right now.
What do you think some of those anxieties are that are attracting people to militant groups and to the belief that civil war is a possibility and maybe it's time to prepare?
One thing that I learned overseas covering civil wars is that the first step down that path is convincing yourself that the other side is bent on your destruction. It's convincing yourself that they do not have good intentions, that the arguments that you have with your neighbors are not political alone, that they're also existential. And I only moved back to America a few years ago, and I was just really struck by the fact that that is how people in America are portraying the political divide right now to a large degree. Just the level of polarization and division, and, you know, actually on all sides of the political spectrum right now, you know, the level to which people are convinced that the other side is out to destroy them is really jarring to me. And I think that's the fundamental anxiety that I really honed in on while I was reporting this piece. And if you look at how President Trump portrays his reelection bid, how even look at the first speech he gave when he announced that he was running for reelection, it's the other side is out to destroy you and your way of life. These are the stakes, and I'm the last thing that's standing in their way. You know, he's obviously tapped into a very deep-seated anxiety that he's able to exist politically and gain traction while speaking in really dire terms like that.
Are there other parallels you see between your reporting on ISIS and civil wars in Iraq, Syria, and Ukraine?
You know, I keep thinking back to when I was in eastern Ukraine before a war broke out there. And I was really like embedded with these protesters who were on the side of Russia. You know, they speak Russian, they have links to Russia, and they're very tuned into Russian media. And they at first were just protesting and taking over local government businesses peacefully because they were convinced that the government in Kiev was out to get them, was going to take away their ability to speak Russian in schools, take away their way of life. And eventually that, you know, over months, as I knew these people, they went from that to they're sending people here to kill us. They're going to arrest us en masse. They're going to, like, Nazis are coming to attack and kill us. And it wasn't true, but they convinced themselves that it was. And, you know, eventually that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it meant that they started taking up weapons defensively, and they started, you know, after they took over government buildings, they started defending them. And then, you know, there were standoffs with the government forces, and then there were small outbreaks of violence, and then there were calls for revenge, and it just kind of spiraled from there. Not that I think that would happen in America necessarily. I think we're a ways off from that, but just the way that people have convinced themselves that their very existence is at stake, and that the other side is just bent on not just winning politically, but destroying them, and that it will be a final destruction, that they won't be able to win the election again in 4 years or fight back through other political means, is very chilling to me.
When you were covering Ukraine, you were kidnapped by pro-Soviet rebels. What do you think you learned about militants from that experience? And you were kidnapped because you were a journalist. And there were other journalists who were being held too. Fortunately, you were released. But do you feel like you learned anything about the mindset of militants, and especially militants who think that journalists are evil?
So I was kidnapped at a checkpoint, and I was put in a bus, I think it was a school bus, and blindfolded. And there were a number of these rebels around on the bus, and they were driving me and some other journalists who had been kidnapped to a place where they planned to interrogate us. And I remember just listening because I couldn't see anything, and feeling the bus slow down to go through a checkpoint that I knew was on the road, and it was a rebel checkpoint, and then hearing them cock their weapons. Like, they were so scared themselves and so clueless as to what was going on, even though they were the ones kidnapping us and supposedly in charge, that they were cocking their weapons even as they rolled through their own checkpoints. And it was just a reminder of the fact that when a war breaks out, and especially a civil conflict, like, it is just confusion. It is just people running blindly around, and really not knowing what to do, and just that chaos itself sort of perpetuating. And I think that's fundamental to understanding, like, what civil conflict really is. It's just, it is not directed clearly. Whatever side you think you're on, you might end up, you know, shooting them by accident, shooting them on purpose. It's just chaos. I can't have, it's just suffering and confusion. And you know, that is what ended up playing out. That was at the very beginning of that war. And I mean, that's what ended up playing out. Like, it's just a senseless war that's gone on for years, where everyone suffers. There's no clear political end. And I'm sure if you went back and re-interviewed every single one of those people that I was with back at the early days when they were starting the war, they would say in a second that they wish that they never had done it.
Do you think about that a lot when you hear people talk about preparing for civil war in the U.S.?
I wish I could take them with me to Iraq or to a place that's actually in a real war, and hold their eyes, you know, open, and have them just really see what it is that they're talking about. I don't think they know. You know, when people talk about civil war, like, you know, Stuart Rhodes talks about Lexington Green, like it's like the glory of the American Revolution, and I want to say, like, no, it's just suffering. It's not the Redcoats versus the Patriots. It's like, it's nonlinear. It's civilians dying for no reason. It's not, you know, tales of heroism. It's tales of people being afraid and sort of causing destruction that they can't make any sense of in the end.
So let's talk about where we are now. Just recently, there was a plan to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. The Center for Strategic and International Studies issued a report just a few days ago that white supremacists and other like-minded groups have committed a majority of the terrorist attacks in the U.S. this year. Earlier this month, the Department of Homeland Security warned that violent white supremacy was the most persistent and lethal threat in the homeland. So when you look ahead to Election Day and the days soon after, what do you see?
You know, if you had asked me in January when I started working on this story, what are like my worst case scenarios for the election, I would have said confusion, people from different sides coming out into the streets and bloodshed erupting just in the confusion of that and in the charged political climate that we're in. And that's what happened actually over the summer. You know, that's what happened in Kenosha. That's what happened in Portland, where there were these confused, muddled standoffs between people fighting from various sides at protests and bloodshed, deadly bloodshed because of it. And, you know, I think when I look at like worst case scenarios for the election, that's still what's in my mind. Just random, confused unrest, like we saw over the summer, maybe on a larger scale, depending on how things go.
Which could be very dangerous.
It is dangerous. And, you know, when we talk about people preparing for a civil war, like, I don't want to get just stuck imagining some kind of distant conflict, you know, worst case scenario. Like, the steps, you know, well short of civil war are still really bad. Street violence is not something that we should be dealing with here in America. Shootings, and confused plots and just chaos like this. I mean, that's bad enough. And all this talk and preparation for violence, I think, can help to fuel that. And it's part of what makes it so dangerous.
Mike Giglio, thank you so much for your reporting and for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Mike Giglio's article about the Oath Keepers is in the current issue of The Atlantic and on The Atlantic website.
Where is a song of love? Where is a song of love? Not a love song between you and me, but a song of love for all humanity. Where is a love song?
Our rock critic Ken Tucker has noticed an uptick in the number of veteran music acts releasing new music right now. From Bruce Springsteen to Stevie Wonder, from The Pretenders to Paul McCartney, musicians approaching 70 and beyond are feeling freshly inspired. Ken has picked three songs that typify this new outpouring and has some ideas about why these new songs sound so good.
The times we're currently living through, from the pandemic to social protests, have stirred many veteran artists to make music for a variety of reasons. Some because they have something to say about the moment, and others because they're going a little stir-crazy. Bruce Springsteen's new album, Letter to You, sounds to me like a little bit of both. It features the return of the E Street Band, and while it's certainly not one of Springsteen's best albums, it is humble and likable. Its most interesting music focuses on the life of a friend of his who died not long ago. It's this departed spirit and others that haunt one of the better songs on the album called Ghosts.
I hear the sound of your guitar.
Yeah.
Social protest has taken many pop music forms in recent months. At one end of the spectrum of old pro musicians, there's Van Morrison, who at age 75 has decided to test his audience's goodwill by releasing a series of anti-lockdown protest songs. Meanwhile, Stevie Wonder, age 70, has engaged with calls for racial equality inspired by the death of George Floyd to insist, as the title of his new single has it, "You can't put it in the hands of fate." On this song, Wonder locks into the rhythm of go-go music, the great Washington, D.C. funk subgenre, and after inviting a slew of rappers, including Busta Rhymes, to say their piece, offers his own hard-headed but highly musical opinion.
You say you're sick and tired of us protesting. I say not tired enough to make a change. You say just to
I be honest with you, there's a song I should have noticed when it was first released earlier this year. That would be Didn't Want to Be This Lonely from The Pretenders and their album Hate for Sale, which came out in July. Buried is the second to the last song on the album, which itself didn't make so much as a ripple in America. Lonely is a fantastic piece of music. Chrissy Hynde pulls off a neat trick. She's very decisive about being ambivalent, about kicking a guy to the curb, while behind her, the Pretenders pound out a Bo Diddley beat. I'm declaring this retroactively the song of the summer, during a time when the seasons seem to have lost their meaning.
Well, I didn't want to be this lonely. Though losing you was a relief from a life with one man only. Devoid of morals or belief. But I didn't want to be. It's lonely. No, I didn't want to be. It's lonely. No, I didn't want to be. It's lonely. No, I didn't want to be. It's lonely.
The cascade of new music from old acts is ceaseless right now. Folks ranging from Willie Nelson to Paul McCartney are turning out new collections. My old favorite, Loudon Wainwright, who I am shocked to say is 74, has momentarily abandoned his own songwriting to sing from the Great American Songbook, complete with big band arrangements, for heaven's sake, on his new collection titled I'd Rather Lead a Band. These are strange times, and sometimes it's what the kids call the olds who produce the best strange times music.
Ken Tucker reviewed new songs by Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Wonder, and The Pretenders. Our next guest, Marcus Samuelson, is perhaps the most celebrated black chef in America today. And he has a new cookbook, which is, well, more than a cookbook. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who first interviewed him on Fresh Air in 2012. I'll let Dave take it from here.
Marcus Samuelson's life story is pretty remarkable. He was born in a poor village in Ethiopia and would likely have died as a toddler from a tuberculosis outbreak had his mother not walked and carried him and his sister 75 miles to Addis Ababa for treatment. His mother didn't survive, but the two children did and were adopted and raised by a family in Sweden. Samuelson grew up, went to culinary school, did apprenticeships in Switzerland and Austria, and made it to the United States, where he made a name for himself as a chef and eventually moved to Harlem. There he opened the Red Rooster, a successful restaurant with close ties to the community, and a menu that includes his take on traditional soul foods, as well as some Swedish and Ethiopian dishes. Samuelson has opened many restaurants, written many cookbooks, won multiple James Beard Awards, and appeared plenty on television. He currently hosts the series No Passport Required on PBS. His new book has plenty of recipes, but it's also an exploration of black influences in American food and a celebration of black excellence in the culinary world. It's called The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. Marcus Samuelson joins me from Knoxville, Tennessee, where he's on location shooting for the Food Channel. Marcus Samuelson, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
In the author's note to this book, you note that in February, you were in Florida setting up a Miami version of your restaurant, The Red Rooster, you know, interviewing chefs, cooks, dishwashers, talking to investors. And then what happened?
Well, then it really, our world changed, right? The restaurant industry, for me, we were in the middle of opening Red Rooster Overtown. And when the pandemic hit our industry and the world, it just changed it forever. My friend Jose Andres was already talking about that we as chefs should join World Central Kitchen. And he's been working with World Central Kitchen for years. And I'm like, yes, Jose, we'll definitely do something. But 2 weeks later, when it was clear that we couldn't open the restaurant, and we actually had to shut the restaurant Red Rooster in Harlem, Jose and World Central Kitchen was probably one of my first calls. So we converted Red Rooster Harlem from a traditional restaurant to a community kitchen. And over the next 6 months, we served collectively over 200,000 meals just from the Harlem location with World Central Kitchen.
This was served outdoors?
Outdoors, and there was a line out the door every day. We served, obviously, the neediest, but we also served first responders, nurses, doctors. And it changed also the outlook for me that chefs, servers, cooks can also be first responders. It also changed fundamentally what the word restaurant, what a restaurant can be in a community, right? The word restaurant actually means to restore your community. And in the worst of times, I think that the restaurant, the hospitality industry really stepped up to serve at that support for the neediest and for the first responders.
Yeah. Describe, if you would, some of the people that would line up to get these meals and whether that changed over time.
Mm. Well, it definitely changed. You know, the first weeks, first of all, no one knew what serving food through social distance looked like, right? But World Central Kitchen had that experience. So they had masks and gloves and knew about 6 feet apart. So we had to learn a new system to serve. And the line was homeless people, people with drug addiction in the beginning. But basically a week or two so into it, it changed. We got more first responders. So we sent cars out to Harlem Hospital, etc. And then about 3 weeks into it, the line completely changed. People started to drive to Red Rooster, jump out of cars and wait in line for an hour or so. And I noticed it was neighbors. It was people who lived down the street from me. It was people who just lost their job. The line got wider. And very often, the dynamics in the line changed. The homeless person, the person used to wait in a line in a shelter, actually coached the working class person on how to wait in line, you know, what was expected, talked about social distancing, and the whole dynamic about the new regulars, the Red Rooster, but also it was fascinating to me. And it became also my haven. You know, it was a place for me when our world was so ripped apart and no one knew what to do. I needed that basic of walking to the 5 blocks it takes for me to leave my house and walk to Red Rooster, the 5 minutes that walk. I needed that walk, but also saw how Harlem as a community quickly, vastly had changed.
Before this happened, you had a lot of going businesses. I mean, you were opening one in Miami, you had the one in Harlem, you had a big one in Rutgers, and well, I have more than one in Harlem, right? I mean, you must have had to lay off a lot of people. That couldn't have been easy.
You know, it was by far the most difficult year in my life. Our whole world was upside down. And yes, layoffs and what's going to happen to our staff was a big part of it. But it was also that balance between, you know, I came as an immigrant 25 years ago. I came with $300. And America and Harlem particularly has been amazing to me and my family, very rewarding. And I wanted to give back. I did not, you know, I'm an immigrant and very privileged. I can go back to Sweden, but I felt it was important for me to stay here and help my community, provide as much as I could, but also be there for my staff. You know, as a chef, my father was a tribe leader in Ethiopia. You don't leave at the toughest time. So it was very important for me, for so many reasons, to stay, fight it out, provide opportunities for the staff, and reorganize as much as possible.
Right. Those were some really rough months in New York. And a lot of people of means left. I mean, they found ways to go and either some had country homes, some rented places. You stayed in Harlem with your wife and son?
You know, I think the blessings for me of being both a black man, but also an immigrant and living in Harlem, all those three, right? I've had all the benefits of the civil rights movement. I wouldn't be here with the rights and the fights of the civil rights movement. So it's a privilege to enter a country as a person of color, and I can now build a business based on that fight. It wasn't the right thing for me to leave, even if it would be the easier way out, you know? You can't come in and take all the benefits, and then when it comes to your turn to chip in, leave. It just doesn't sit right for me and my family. And we discussed it. It wasn't that we weren't frustrated. It wasn't like my wife and I felt like everything was great. But there was also a lot of these things that I said, this is something that we might have to do and we should be doing. Walking in Harlem, you know, a community like Harlem that is so amazing, you think about it from all the history and the culture, especially African-American culture that is in this incredible village, but also so quickly did it go down to a very despair community, right? Based on many different reasons. When you think about the injustices in society, for example, the homeless population every day was dumped into Harlem to 125th Street. Rikers Island population was dumped in to 125th Street, right? So there was all of these other forces that, you know, when people say they left, no one was left in New York, I said nothing could be further from the truth. All the working people in New York stayed. And fear is a rich man's game. That's what one of my line cooks said. And I really agree with that.
So let's talk about this book of yours. It's really much more than a cookbook. You say that it's an opportunity to eat deliciously, but it's also a cookbook about race, class, and the equity of the American food landscape. What do you mean?
Well, when I think about American food and the black experience, it's almost like we're written out of the food history. And this is important to take authorship and replace African-American experience into American food history, right? And it's just like American history in general. It's very complex, and it's not written with people of color and black people in mind, right? So the authorship of American food, so much of it, we should thank African-American contribution for it. And there's a lot of celebration there. And the more we know about blackness and food, we do understand how complex it is. It's not monolithic, and it's highly layered. And therefore, it's also uniquely American, not just for the black population of America, for all of America. For me, I think the best parallel is with American music, right? When we think about American music, you cannot think about American music without the contribution of black people, whether it's gospel, R&B, rock and roll, to today's hip-hop or funk, right? And each label of those music really lays an opportunity of clarity. You think about James Brown, you think about Prince, you think about Miles Davis, for example. That's really how I would love for us to learn about the contribution of American cooks, particularly black American women, because they contributed the most.
You know, if anybody is in a position to understand many different cultures, it's you, given the course of your life. And I have to say, I learned a lot about your life from the episode of Anthony Bourdain's series Parts Unknown, in which you and your wife, Maya, went with him on a trip to Ethiopia. And this was really fascinating. You know, you left there as a toddler and went to Sweden. At what point did you reconnect with your family there, or had you always stayed in touch?
My sister, my biological sister, Linda Fantai, was really the one that made sure we stayed connected to Ethiopia. She was much more curious about it, while I was just busy working and building my career. And one day she just says, I think we can find our birth father. She'd then been in contact with the adopting agency in Ethiopia that helped us be adopted. And I said to her, well, we'll have to speak to our mother, a Swedish mother, because I felt like our mom had done a great job raising us, but I didn't want to go behind her back. So I called mom, and mom said, like, of course, when are we going? We have to. If we can find him, we all were in. And it took about 2 years later, because we needed verification and all of that stuff. But, you know, about 2 years later, I was in Ethiopia. This is around right after 9/11, actually. And it really changed the trajectory of my life.
Yeah.
You know, my journey, just like the we talk about in The Rise, it's very, very complex, right? It has adoption. I have white parents. I am Ethiopian, but I don't speak the language. So how much of that is our son Zion Ethiopian, for example? How much is he American? He goes to Sweden every year. How much is that? So my point is, life in general is highly complex and layered. When you add race and identity, it adds more layers to that. But that's also the beauty in life, right? To come to terms with that. And it's something that I've spent my life to be able to figure out. And I'm fortunate enough to be able to do it through creativity.
One other little personal note here. You know, your restaurants and your menus and your recipes are really diverse and colorful. And I've seen a lot of pictures of you, and you dress very colorfully with patterned pants, scarves, hats.
Yes.
It's nothing subtle. Is this a form of creative expression for you? Is there a message here?
You know, it's funny because I would say two things. When you dress in Harlem and you look at the incredible Dapper Dan and Miss Lana Turner, dressing has always been part of an African identity, but also a sad journey in American history, right? As black men, we had to dress up, right? We have modern example of that. If we didn't look in a certain way, and still a certain way, police officers can round us up, and it can still happen. It still happens, right? But for me, dressing signals a way that we hear, in a way that I tied back to Africa. Color and patterns is very tribal. I think I dress very shy, you know. but it was always funny because my mom, you know, in Sweden, she always said, you know, in the whole Swedish mantra, it was, don't stick out, just be normal. And I said, Mom, there's 500 kids in the school. We're the only black kids. You know, that's not going to happen. So, you know, we've learned to have a lot of fun with it. And yeah.
Coming back to where we started, you've had a lot of restaurants. And before the pandemic, you had a lot of businesses going with lots of employees. What's the future for restaurants?
I look at it, I would answer that in two ways, short term and long term. I think long term, the future of American restaurant will be fantastic because people realizing that without restaurants, local restaurants, American neighborhoods and cities will look completely different. You look at the transformation that local restaurant has done to communities in Brooklyn, communities in Harlem, and so on. You can travel anywhere in this country today, and there's great local restaurants with all different ethnic background. And that's something that people are not going to go back and say, those places don't matter, right? So we need restaurants, because once the restaurants are gone, the restaurants are really the soul of the heartbeat of that community. Because once you don't have a restaurant, you don't have a barbershop, you don't have a coffee shop, you don't have other sorts of retails. So for quality of life, that balance between what I can order in, what I can get from the big boxes such as Amazon, but also the smaller, the more personal conversation. Those are happening in restaurants and cafes and bars. And I do know that Americans acknowledge and want that lifestyle back. We can agree on that we want to be social. We just have to do it in a safe way. In a short-term way, I do think that we're going to go in to the most challenging winter we've ever done as a restaurant hospitality community. We're going to need our customer to support us more than ever, whether that is ordering takeout, whether that's us as in the industry coming up with new entrepreneurship to meeting the customer where they're at. And we're also going to need help from the government. The government actually has to govern and navigate all people, not just the big companies. You know, the people that work in American restaurant, independent restaurant, we represent between 11 and 16 million people, how you count it, right? Whether it's the people that actually work in the restaurant, the ancillary, different job that comes out of restaurant. So it's a very, very important part of everyday experience as Americans. As we have said, we want this type of society.
Well, Marcus Samuelson, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Marcus Samuelson is a multiple James Beard Award-winning chef and host of the PBS series No Passport Required. His new book is called The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food.